Welcome to Impact AI, brought to you by Pixel Scientia Labs. I'm your host, Heather Couture. On this podcast, I interview innovators and entrepreneurs about building a mission-driven, machine learning-powered company. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to my newsletter to be notified about new episodes. Plus, follow the latest research in computer vision for people in planetary health. You can sign up at pixelscientia.com/newsletter. Today, I'm joined by guest David Marvin. David was the co-founder and CEO of Salo Sciences, which was acquired by Planet last year, and is now product lead for forest ecosystems at Planet. And today, we're going to talk about monitoring forests. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Heather. Glad to be here.
David, could you share a bit about your background and how that led you to Salo Sciences and then Planet?
Sure. My background is in forest ecology. I received my PhD from the University of Michigan about a decade ago now. And then I went on to work for the Carnegie Institution for Science, which is based at Stanford University, as a postdoc. And throughout my PhD and postdoc work, I focused on understanding how tropical forests are changing in response to climate change, and uncover some of what the drivers are in terms of how climate change impacts tropical forest carbon and carbon dynamics, and so how carbon moves in and out of tropical forests at large scales. And I use a number of different tools to get this question, from running experiments in the forest using elevated carbon dioxide levels, to field work, going out to the field, painstakingly measuring trees with diameter tapes and staking out plots to do those measurements within, all the way up to leveraging airborne and satellite-based remote sensing platforms to be able to, at scale, understand change over time and identify things like tree species and the amount of carbon contained within forests at large scales. But throughout this entire time in academia, there was always this lingering question and desire to be doing something larger, and not just larger in terms of, is the question I'm asking, the right one? Usually something that just leads to a publication in a scientific journal, which of course is critical, right? We have to be asking these smaller contained questions to be building on the knowledge base that scientists create for other scientists and for applied practitioners and policymakers to be able to answer and do their jobs properly. But to me, there was always this missing piece of, can I be doing something bigger and, kind of getting at the direct, like, if climate change is really making such large impact on tropical forests, and not necessarily right now, but in the future, this was 10 years ago, right? We didn't really have the same level of large scale changes and evidence we have now. Could we be answering bigger questions, but also working at bigger scales? And so, having that kind of multi-scale experience, working with experiments on seedlings all the way to working with satellites, over whole countries, I really felt drawn towards the bigger picture of trying to map very large areas and answer these bigger questions. And it was in my postdoc time at Carnegie that I met and became close friends with my eventual co-founder, Christopher Anderson, who was a staff member at the time in the research lab that we were in. He was responsible for being on the aircraft the lab operated, which had an incredible sensor package. And I'll get a bit more about what that means and how that's important for mapping forests more generally. But he operated a number of the sensors on the airplane. So got to fly all over the tropics, Central and South America, Africa, Hawaii, and just had an incredible experience working with the actual instruments that collected the data we used at the time, and then eventually the data we're using now here at Planet. And he too had some of these same, feelings around, what's the right question to be asking, and, am I doing enough? And so we had a lot of conversations where we were just stunned by the incredible amount of data and science that was being done in the lab we were at and labs around the world. But what really bothered us was often you would get a grant, do the research, publish on it, and then move on to the next grant, do the research, publish on it, move on. And it was very rare you had academic labs that could effectively work both at large scales, be able to produce an applied product that others could use. Since the kind of goal of academics is really about that publication, and like that's the be all end all, that's the currency of academia, is those publications and getting out as many as you can in high profile journals. It doesn't really provide everyone else who's not in academia with effective tools to answer their questions, make better decisions, and be able to think holistically about climate change, the impact on forests, and the way that their behaviors can change to do better work to be able to reduce the impact of climate and the impact of humans on forests. And so we decided that there has to be a better way that's outside academia, because there really didn't see any pathway of staying in academia and doing this effectively. And so we decided, let's start our own thing. And it really was just like, what's that thing going to be? And we looked at a few different options, right? The first thing was immediately, should we start a nonprofit? That seemed like it made sense. It was not really meant to be a commercial, you know, business, and it was very academic focused. But we quickly heard from a lot of mentors that we had at the time that carries a lot of overhead and a lot of additional work that you two as individuals with no experience doing this and a focus on like building something don't have time and don't have money for. The easiest, simplest thing is start a for-profit entity. It gives you much more flexibility and control and without the need to have the overhead of a nonprofit. And so we decided, yeah, we would incorporate a company and start building. And we did this, you know, on the side, nights and weekends. We both had full-time jobs at the time. Chris was a PhD student at Stanford by that point. I positioned with the Nature Conservancy in the California chapter as a research scientist. And so we spent about 2.5 years working nights and weekends, literally stereotypical Silicon Valley, but we were in a garage in San Francisco, you know, working on this in our spare time. It took us a while, you know, 2.5 years of on the side work to get us to the point where we had enough of a product and system working to be able to actually do some consulting work that brought in revenue that let me leave my position at TNC to go full time to Salo. When Chris finished his PhD about 1.5 years after that, he came in full time. We began hiring, eventually built the company to only around 8, you know, employees total, including ourselves. But we had enough traction in the market. We had enough of a product market fit and revenue coming in that, you know, it was a profitable company by the time Planet approached us and we began talking an acquisition. And ultimately, you know, we were in this pretty incredible position where we had kind of built and grown a bootstrapped company to profitability, had full control over it. Our biggest need at that time was, how do we go faster and how do we go bigger? You know, we found ourselves back in that same position. We were 4 or 5 years previous where we felt like we needed to do something bigger and faster because the issue at hand, there was not enough going on to resolve kind of the dual crises of climate change and biodiversity loss in tropical forests and forests worldwide for that matter. And so we were at our own crossroads with the company of, how do we make it go faster and bigger? And the options were, keep going as we're going, organically build it, get outside investment, likely through a venture capital firm, or get acquired. And ultimately we pursued all of those different paths, worked through them, and decided that doing an acquisition, you know, through Planet, who, you know, I'll get to more detail in a moment, but build and operate satellite systems, right? And our data was built on satellite imagery. We were like, what better place to go and build this faster and better than the folks producing those data? So it just really made a lot of sense to go inside Planet. We knew the founders already through longstanding partnership with the company. Their vision aligned exactly with ours around doing good for the planet and for nature. And so it was an easy call in the end to come to Planet.
That must have been an exciting transition for you. Congratulations.
Thank you. We never set out when we first started the company and really hadn't even thought about any of this stuff until really the year before the acquisition. You know, we're two scientists and we had to completely learn how to run and operate a business, how to manage teams, how to hire. These were not skill sets that we had any experience with. I think pretty sure for both Chris and I, our first for-profit jobs was with this company. So literally had no organizational experience inside of a for-profit company. So very different world for us, for sure. But we found our way through and, you know, really enjoyed the time kind of independently operating and building a company, and are really excited about the future where we can go from here. And also, to be remiss if I don't mention, a few years in, we brought on a third co-founder, Kyle Gertrich. Kyle had been a longtime friend and colleague who was an attorney by training. And we actually used to live in the same house in San Francisco when I first moved to the city from my postdoc. And so he was following along from the very, very beginning. He actually helped advise us on the side a little bit right in the beginning, just about entity formation and how to think about intellectual property and how to think about growing a company. But no one had ever said, like, oh, you should think about what people often hear now term, like, what's your exit strategy? Never thought about that at all. And so we didn't have one. We're like, I don't know, build the company, make it profitable and run it the rest of our lives, right? That's how people do. It was a really eye-opening experience to have companies approach us to be acquired and thinking about what that meant for our futures. But in the end, like I said, you know, a company like Planet, you know, was essentially probably the only company we would have really ever been acquired by, just given their vision and that they have their own satellites and we raise satellite software company.
So let's talk a little bit more about Salo Sciences. What did you do there? What were you building?
The original vision and the mission of the company was always build solutions that can help other organizations make effective decisions around climate change and tropical forest loss. And we never really deviated from that broader mission. That was always what we intended to do and what we still intend to do here at Planet. How we got there was a little circuitous. Our first revenue and our initial projects ended up being about wildfire because we were living in California. You know, we first began actually being successful with our software pipelines. It was right around the time of the wildfire crisis in California really kicking off, you know, 2017, 2018. And those really intense wildfire years in California, we saw an immediate application of our technology, not to tropical forests right off the bat, but to being able to help map the fuels, the vegetation fuels that drive wildfire behavior in California. And so we received some early funding from the USDA for their SBIR program to help build a system to map tree mortality across California. At the time, there was also a really huge tree mortality crisis occurring because of a long-term ecological drought in California. And you had something like 90 to 100 million trees dying off per year. And the best way to map them at the time was to fly airplanes with a trained observer looking out the window and hand drawing big, you know, circles and squares on a map, on a tablet of where they saw mortality. And we're like, come on, there's got to be a better way. Like, we know there is. That's this approach, leveraging satellite imagery and machine learning properly to be able to create these really highly resolved and accurate maps that can be updated regularly for mortality. So that was our first, you know, funding that came in, our first real project was this mortality map of California. But as we got into more of like the wildfire community that would want to use this data, we saw more areas where our technology would be able to be applied and make a difference. And that became this much larger project that became termed the Forest Observatory, where we would use satellite imagery and deep learning technology to extract high quality layers of vegetation fuels that are inputs to wildfire behavior models here in the Western US. Because at the time, and really still to this day, one of the main data sets for running these models is a national data set called Landfire that was never intended to be used in this way, but it is kind of the core data set that folks use to run fire models. and it's, you know, really doesn't work very well at high resolution. So, you know, at the kind of tree to stand scale, it's meant for large scale county and state level mapping. And so it's pretty inaccurate. It's updated pretty irregularly. I think it's gotten better these days, but, you know, 6 or so years ago, every 2 years and take a couple of years of work after the imagery was acquired to actually be released. And so it was always lagging, pretty inaccurate and pretty coarse resolution. So what we did, what kind of really became the foundation of the systems that we still have today, was we leveraged high quality airborne LIDAR measurements of forests all over California. And so airborne LIDAR is one of these technologies, these sensors that was on that airplane back in my postdoc lab, that shoots out hundreds of thousands of pulses of laser light per second and reflects back to the sensor. And it can basically recreate in three dimensions a forest or a city, you know, whatever your kind of mapping target is. But it's extremely precise. It's, you know, centimeter level accuracy, and, you know, it's very high quality data. And so we consider that the gold standard of forest measurement. And we can take that 3D LIDAR scan and convert it into these two-dimensional maps of metrics like the height of the forest or the canopy cover of a forest or what's termed canopy base height, which is the height above ground of the first branches of trees in a forest. All these different really high quality metrics can then be paired with satellite imagery and then fed into a deep learning model so that the model can learn from that high quality LIDAR data how to extract those measurements just from the satellite imagery. And then once that model's been trained, it can be applied to contiguous large scale maps, let's say all of California or the whole Western US, of just satellite imagery without additional airborne LIDAR data, make predictions of every pixel across that area. And so the entirety, the wall-to-wall map of Western US, we can predict the height of every tree at each location across the Western US, even though airborne LIDAR only covers a fraction of that same area. And so that was really kind of what, you know, really broke things open for us, was leveraging large-scale airborne LIDAR collections and deep learning to be able to create these really nice maps of vegetation fuels that could be used then to power wildfire models. But even though the product was focused on wildfire and wildfire-related fuels, the same concept can be used to map tree height, tree cover, and above-ground carbon in forests all over the world. And so the application of that same system can be kind of pointed at a number of problems and be used to produce a number of products that would be really valuable. And so that was kind of what got us our start.
And then now at Planet, are you focused on something quite similar or have your goals changed?
Very similar, but much larger scale. And so what we're doing now at Planet is we're leveraging those same types of systems, but building out tooling infrastructure to do it globally. And so back in October of 2023, you know, just around 6 months ago, only 9 months into our, you know, post-acquisition period, we released Planet's first global map of above ground carbon, tree height, and tree cover at 30 meter resolution. So not as high resolution as the work we're doing now, but it was meant to be a backward looking, more coarse resolution version of what we're building towards currently, so that people could use these data sets to look at over time, what is the change in carbon height and cover to evaluate the suitability of new forest carbon projects around the world that are meant to leave more carbon in the forests than there are at the current moment. And so having a historical look back and ability to see trends over time is really key to enabling better locations and types of forest carbon projects all over the world. Ultimately, what we want to produce is a near tree level map of the world's forests. And we're well on our way to doing that and expect to be releasing that later this summer or in the fall.
When we were working on this at Salus Sciences, was this already based on Planet imagery or were you working with other satellite constellations at the time?
So that's the other key factor that early on we discovered was really important. Much of the academic work on leveraging remote sensing and machine learning was focusing on using a single sensor like Landsat or a Sentinel to be able to train and run these models. What we did was take multiple different data sets from different sensors, stack them all together, and train the models on what's now termed multi-sensor fusion feature data sets. So we like to use all available satellite imagery that we know, you know, makes sense to apply to this problem, because each one, even if they're the same type of satellite, so for instance, Landsat and Sentinel-2 are both multispectral satellite sensors. These, it just means that they measure only a handful of wavelengths of light. And each have a green band that they're measuring. The exact wavelength of green light that they're measuring differs a small amount. And just that difference right there gives us different information about the surface of the Earth. And this was an insight that the lab that we worked in back at Carnegie had, because they were working with a different sensor that was on the airplane called a hyperspectral sensor. And instead of measuring 8 to 12 or 16 bands of light, it would measure 400 wavelengths of light. And it gave you continuous, essentially, ability to look at the whole spectrum from visible to shortwave infrared light that reflects off the surface of the Earth and back to a sensor. In this case, it was on an airplane. And it's an enormous amount of data, and it's extremely high quality information, but it's hard to work with, right? Right now, we're running models on 20, 25 band data sets. This is 400 bands of data. Difficult problem to work with, but we found out, and this was we as in the entire lab through many years of academic study, that leveraging all of those wavelengths of light is actually more powerful than trying to feature select, and so pull out a subset of the best performing wavelengths, because each one is, it has its own unique interaction, the wavelength of light, with a target. In our case, mainly it's leaves and branches of trees. And it gives you a distinct piece of information about what is happening on the ground. You know, in the case of hyperspectral data, it can tell you about the chlorophyll content or the leaf water content of invisible leaves. It can tell you about defense compounds or the structure of the canopy. And so we knew that using all these different sensors would help us to create better outputs. Second key insight, again, the focus in academic literature at the time was really on machine learning methods that were single pixel only. And so we'd look at one pixel of your feature set from satellite imagery, look at one pixel of your airborne LiDAR, or whatever your ground-based data was to train on, and it would try to do one-to-one, you know, pixel predictions and learning. We leveraged convolutional neural networks instead, which let us take into account the context around those target pixels. And so it wasn't just a single pixel, it was area-based machine learning, essentially, to make it simplified. And so those two techniques, using multiple different sensors, using kind of context-based convolutional neural networks, open kind of the gates for us to do far better quality mapping that was very different than what was being done at the time. And so these are things we continue to use here at Planet. And the difference now is, instead of as a partner of Planet having access to just a small amount of data, which we were able to do through a partnership back at Salo, we have access to their entire catalog of data, which goes back, you know, almost 8 years now, with a high resolution data set, the 3-meter data called PlanetScope. And it lets us work with data from all over the world. And so we have this amazing spatiotemporal data set to begin building and training our models on in a way that as a partner, we just could never have had. And so we learned a lot about planet imagery and of course other sources as well during our time at Salo. So we came in kind of already as experts on the data, but now we have a totally different understanding of the data and a much better grasp of it, and can leverage the power of the internal systems and tools that we would never have had as a partner before being on the inside.
So you mentioned that you train these models by using airborne LiDAR as essentially your ground truth, you know, the assessment of the canopy heights and the different measurements you're taking, but then you use satellite imagery as your input. You only have LiDAR for certain locations. So how do you validate that your models work in places where you don't have LiDAR? You know, maybe it's a different part of the country, maybe it's even a different continent. Are you able to validate that your models generalize to different locations?
That's a key question, and it's one of the major focus of our group in Planet is to, number one, collect as much openly available airborne LiDAR that we can. And to date, we've collected this today, as in like from Salo through Planet. So about 5 years now, we've been working on this. We've collected about 14 million square kilometers of airborne LiDAR from all around the world. We think this is probably the largest public or private repository of airborne LiDAR in the world. Even at that number, you know, 14 million square kilometers, which is a huge number for airborne LiDAR, we have covered a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the world, obviously. What's, you know, important now is trying to fill in a lot of the gaps where we don't have a lot of airborne LiDAR. And to your exact point here, not having much or any airborne LiDAR from certain regions of the world could introduce a bias, number one, in terms of our model output and its ability to make predictions, but also leaves us kind of high and dry for evaluating its performance in those regions. And so to address kind of both of these issues, first, to evaluate model performance, where we do have good airborne LiDAR, what we do is we retain around 15-20% of all of the airborne LiDAR coverage. We remove it, keep it out of our trained data set, out of a validation data set from the modeling, and use it to test the model performance independently. But that only gives us good test data over places where we have airborne LiDAR, obviously. And then what we do is collect or utilize other existing, well-known, well-calibrated data around the world. And this mainly comes from two sources. One, field plot data collected from universities or governments all around the world. And so we have around 500,000 field plots that are geo-referenced locations that we can do these comparisons with. And then we also leverage a space-borne system called JEDI. This is the Global Ecosystem Dynamics Investigation. It's a space-borne LiDAR on the space station. And this gives us very broad coverage between 50 north and 50 south latitude, at least. And so kind of the higher latitudes are missed, unfortunately, on this sensor. But otherwise, it's very well distributed, and it is LiDAR measurements from space that are covering the whole of the Earth, and they're georeferenced for the most part. There's a bit of some quality issues there, but we're able to use that data set as a completely independent way to evaluate our predictions of our height and cover models. And so we approach it, the validation aspect, from a few different, you know, angles, trying to source as many different independent data sets as possible to do validation. And then we also like to do comparisons to well-known public data sets, either from academia or from governments, folks who have done similar global maps of height, cover, or carbon. We will compare data to those, since they've often been, you know, gone through rigorous peer review or vetting by government scientists, to just show how our performance compares to those similar types of data sets. And we're putting out a really extensive validation report on our global 30-meter data set later this week, or early next week, I believe it'll be coming out, that goes into depth on both validation and comparison of our data to all these different sources. Now, on the bias question, there's a lot that our team thinks about and works on to be able to reduce the bias that results from only having data in a heterogeneous distribution of LiDAR sites around the world. Unfortunately, there is so much of this LiDAR we have that we essentially have LiDAR in every forested biome in the world. And so the model, when it's making a prediction somewhere, likely has seen a similar forest, whether in that exact biome or in a similar type of biome where the structure of the forest is close enough where we're not getting like wildly terrible predictions in places where we don't have any data. It does a pretty good job of being able to predict without ever having seen that forest. Because in our point of view, forests just don't look that different globally. The range of variation of forests compared to, let's say, the range of variation of human faces is just much more constrained, especially when you're talking about satellite imagery and not something like drone-based imagery where you're getting like each leaf resolved. We're just seeing like tree crowns and the structure of tree crowns over forests. The models we're leveraging were built to be able to handle things like facial recognition, which is a far more complex and much larger, I think, variability face-to-face than, you know, forest-to-forest over the world. And so that helps us, you know, initially off the bat, make good predictions, but we're always trying to think about how to tune the model and, you know, shift our sampling strategies so that we can reduce our bias in predictions.
To build effective models for forests like you've done here, it sounds like you need a fair amount of knowledge, not just in machine learning, but also about remote sensing with the LiDAR and satellite imagery that you use, and about forests themselves and trees. How is all that knowledge integrated in order to help your machine learning developers create these powerful models?
That's a great question. And it's a particular insight that we have come to understand over the last, you know, decade or so of working on this, not just at Salo, but beyond our academic work, is you really need to have domain expertise in all three to make this work well. It's really difficult to come from the machine learning community with zero background in biology or ecology of forests and be able to produce high quality and scalable models like this. And so what we have focused on primarily is in building our team at Salo and now here at Planet is trying to bring in folks who have at least expertise in two out of those three, whether it's you have a background in remote sensing and machine learning, but no ecology background, or you have an ecology background with really deep experience in machine learning, but maybe no remote sensing experience. We try to get two of those three because we think, given the composition of our team here at Planet, who collectively have deep expertise in all three of those areas, we can get some up to speed pretty quick in some of their missing background. But not being strong in one of them is definitely a large detriment. And we've seen this again and again with oftentimes it'd be customers we'd be talking to back at Salo. They'd be like, yeah, we're thinking about using your data, but I don't know, we got really good machine learning team here. We're just going to give it a shot and try to produce it ourselves. And we'd be like, cool, see you in a year. And almost always, you know, 6 to 9 to 12 months later, they'd be back being like, boy, was that difficult. And we did not do a great job. Let's talk about using your data. And so you really do have to have kind of the three legs of the stool to be able to build a quality operational product that is meant for forest monitoring.
You mentioned publishing earlier, and publishing papers is the primary goal in academia, but in industry, it's definitely not. And yet on Salo Science's website and on Planet as well, I see a number of research articles. What business benefits have you seen from publishing?
We continue to publish and make publishing a priority with our group here at Planet. And I think a number of the other product focus groups here at Planet do as well. I think this really comes from leadership here at Planet that values and understands the necessity of continuing to work on primary and applied science as part of the business strategy. It's very hard in this vertical of forest monitoring, and I'll extend it over to ag monitoring as well, when you're producing a brand new product like this that hasn't really been seen before, people are going to be skeptical. A lot of your end users are going to be government agency scientists. Their first question is going to be, let me see the validation. Do you have it peer reviewed yet? Even though they're the ultimate users of the data, they don't control like the budget and they don't control the decision to buy that data, but they're going to be the ones that give the green light, yes or no, to the person who's going to make that decision. And so making sure you have scientists on your team, making sure you're still active in the scientific publishing community, that you're up on the latest papers that are coming out, and basically acting like a scientist in an industry position is crucial to make any product work, especially in brand new markets like forest monitoring and carbon markets. We hear it all the time, and it's a crucial piece of it. Granted, we haven't yet published on this most recent product, but we have one in the works. We plan on publishing at least two or three papers over the next year on these new products coming out, because one, it's critical to get that scientific validation through peer review, but it also lets the community know, hey, this is something that we've done that's new. Come try it out. Come try our data out. Give us feedback on where you see it not working well. Come critique it. We want to leverage that feedback to improve the product over time. And it's hard to do that. You don't have publication that you can pass around to other scientists and a data set that also is in a public repository. And that's one of the other, you know, kind of key alignments that we have with Planet was their focus on impact and a public good data set. And what we're doing now is working with the impact team here at Planet, led by Andrew Zolli, to figure out what is going to be our digital public good strategy, where we can make a lot of these data on forest carbon and height and cover available, you know, for free to the research community to evaluate and build new discoveries on top of. That's a key strategy that Will, the CEO, and Robbie, the co-founder, have always had, is getting this data out there and into the hands of researchers who can make discoveries and really push the envelope. Because we all know as scientists, there's not budget in their tight grant cycles to buy data sets. It's spent on other things. So they're just in default to using free data. We prefer if they're using higher quality free data than kind of the status quo that's been out there. And so we really see publication, open data, and engagement, especially with the scientific community, as key factors in uptake and acceptance far outside of that community.
That's good to hear. It helps advance not just what you're building, but enables others to build upon it and extend what you're doing and use your data, advancing science overall.
Yeah, the ultimate goal, right, still goes back to why we started Salo Sciences. It's around how do we build better tools that includes data to combat climate change and the biodiversity crisis. And if that means, you know, losing a small amount of revenue from what you might be able to get from some grants here and there to let scientists build and understand the world, systems in the world in a different way, you know, that's part of the mission. That's part of why we started Salo and why we continue working towards it at Planet.
Is there any advice you could offer to other leaders of AI-powered startups?
Going back to the earlier question on those three domain pieces, right? Ecology, machine learning, and remote sensing. We still see it today. And I think we're seeing it less and less, but a new company starts and they have a business model around some really incredible, you know, end market platform or tool. And they just assume that, well, we have machine learning scientists working on this part of the platform. We can just have them also work on the data production. Like, can't be that hard. Don't do it. You're going to waste a lot of your investors' money and a lot of your time. Focus on what your actual product is. And if it is not producing data from satellite imagery, if it's just utilizing it as part of a workflow or a platform or some kind of a insight for a customer, don't build it yourselves. Go to the range of different folks out there who are doing really high quality work to extract data from satellite imagery. I don't mean just in forests, I mean all types of industries. It's a very hard, complex problem. It has taken us over a decade to get there. It has taken the competitors to Planet. Almost all of them are founded and led by former academics that we used to know and work with back at Carnegie. The world is very small in forest carbon mapping, and it continues to be very small. And now the business world around forest carbon mapping and data is still that same very small group. It has not grown substantially because it is so hard, because it requires such deep domain knowledge to do correctly. And also, I think to the other point, from a business level, you need credibility and you need to be able to talk to other scientists and understand the lingo and understand the historical, you know, development of these systems and kind of the academic history of it to be credible. And so that would be my main piece of advice, is don't try to do the data piece if your ultimate product is not the data itself. I think the other piece of advice is stick with it. You probably have heard this already, but I want to reiterate this, that there will be times that you, in your heart, think, maybe even know you're going to fail and you're not going to get through. You've got to gut it out. As long as you are disciplined about your runway, disciplined about being realistic about revenue coming in and your ability to close deals on realistic timelines, push through the hard parts. Because eventually, if you really are building a amazing product that can change things, you will eventually get uptake. You've got to just stay in business long enough to get there. And boy, did Chris and I hit some hard times throughout our 5-6 years at Salo before finally, and it was very much like year, like very little revenue. Then finally, boom, like it just took off in a couple of years. And so you've got to just be able to wait it out until you can get to that point where you get product market fit and you get enough customers to really believe in what you're producing.
And finally, where do you see the impact of the forest monitoring efforts at Planet in 3 to 5 years?
My hope is that we continue to build these global products that bring really high value to not just the forest carbon market, which is kind of the initial real focus of this data, to bring, you know, transparency and accuracy to a marketplace right now that's suffering from some pretty major credibility and transparency issues. But just far beyond that, to really anyone that is working to restore nature, protect nature, and to fight climate change, we want to build the data that lets you focus on that mission and not on all the very long and deep upstream issues to extract and find high quality data to go into your system or go into your study, go into your product. We want to be able to power a number of these solutions, you know, all over the world in all different industries, where if you were trying to make a difference in, you know, leaving more trees in place, leaving more carbon in the ground, alternatively, removing more trees and more fuels in wildfire prone areas, we want to help make that happen faster, at larger scale, and cheaper, so that the work can just get done. Someone told me last week, they were like, we have 70 months till 2030. And I like that they were thinking in that like granularity of months, not just years. But 2030 is kind of this key global deadline for climate change, for biodiversity, for a number of global problems that we're facing. And we're so far off track right now, and we don't have much time to turn around. And we're already seeing the impacts, you know, month over month, year over year. And it's way worse than anyone thought 10 years ago. So we want to help people go faster, go bigger, not make cost such a big issue. I think in 3 to 5 years, success to me would be if Planet is known as one of the global standards for high quality data on all types of hard problems, whether it's wildfire, carbon, sustainable agriculture, restoration of nature. Planet should be known as kind of the go-to data source for trusted, accurate, and usable data to produce better outcomes.
This has been great, David. I appreciate your insights today. I think this will be valuable to many listeners. Where can people find out more about you online?
You can go to planet.com, find out about a lot of the different data solutions that we're currently producing, whether it's in forest or agriculture, civil government, and beyond. But the next kind of, you know, vision, the future of Planet is going to be, you know, taking that data and producing insights. And so I think just next month, we're launching kind of a new platform to help folks do this. And so keep your eye out for new and upcoming insight-based products from Planet. Via our website, or I think on Twitter as well, will be a great resource to kind of follow along.
Perfect. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. Thanks for listening. I'm Heather Couture, and I hope you join me again next time for Impact AI. Thank you for listening to Impact AI. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share with a friend. And if you'd like to learn more about computer vision applications for people and planetary health, you can sign up for my newsletter at pixelscientia.com/newsletter.